This is Peace Talks Radio, a series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with Megan Kamrick. How do we find peace, and how do we make peace last? It's easy to lose hope when faced with conflicts that seem intractable. But there are people working on solutions, even reaching across divides that seemed insurmountable in the past. On this edition of Peace Talks Radio, we talk with Noga Harpaz, an Israeli, and Raed al-Hadar, a Palestinian, who are part of Combatants for Peace. This is the group that's committed to nonviolence, and it was launched in 2006 by former combatants who believe the cycle of violence can only stop when Israelis and Palestinians join forces. Their work was the focus of the documentary Disturbing the Peace. Now, a little later in the program, we'll talk with Peter T. Coleman, a psychologist with the Teachers College at Columbia University and director of the Morton Deutsch International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. He and his team study peaceful societies to understand how peace is sustained. It's a very different approach from the typical strategy of studying peace processes after conflict. Coleman compares it to medicine that focuses on promoting wellness rather than treating disease. But again, we'll start with Raed al-Hadar. Now, he's one of the founders of Combatants for Peace. When he was 8, he saw his cousin killed by an Israeli settler while tending his lands. During the first Intifada, one of his best friends in high school was killed by an Israeli soldier during a protest. This drove al-Hadar to take revenge, and he was arrested while trying to build a failed bomb. While in prison, he was convinced armed conflict was the only way to end the occupation, but gradually his thinking changed. Another cousin died in the second Intifada, and he began to question if violence was the correct path. His answers to questions put to him by Megan Kamrick are translated by Serene Akkad.
What was the first idea that somehow, if we can talk to each other, this could be another way? If we could talk to Israelis?
يعني أنا كان في سنة 2004
In 2004, he met with a group of Israelis inside of Israel, and he realized that these Israelis do want peace for Palestinians and don't acknowledge the occupation of the Palestinians, and like the Palestinians, they want peace for them as well. During the second Intifada, he realized that not only were Palestinians being killed, also Israelis were being killed, not at the same rate, but also many Israelis lost their lives as well. Many people on both sides lost loved ones, and through this, they were able to relate. So he started meeting with these Israelis on a day-to-day basis and started discussing joining forces to bring about peace in a nonviolent way. From their point of view, there were the Palestinians that were throwing stones and attacking them and using any chance that they could to attack them. And on their end, there were the Israeli soldiers that could have killed their loved ones or destroyed their homes.
The gatherings, people give their own stories. Why is that important to building trust, even though it can be very difficult to listen to?
Yeah.
First of all, we can't build trust within another if we don't open our minds to one another. And we opened our hearts to one another. And we listen to each other very well. Because there are borders and walls that are built between us, those walls need to come down. If we actually stop and take the time to listen to one another and actually choose to listen, we can break down these borders between us. It wasn't easy for us to build trust with one another, or even to be sitting on the same table. We actually weren't believing it ourselves. The people around us were actually thought of it as very weird.
Your community thought?
Yeah.
His mother asked him, "Are you crazy? You're going to meet with these people?" These people, one of them could have been the ones that killed your friend.
I want to turn to Noga Harpaz.
Yeah.
What was your experience like growing up in Israel? Did you experience attacks or fear of attacks?
My early childhood was during quite an optimistic time in Israel. It was the early 90s. So we have just signed an agreement with a peace agreement with Jordan. We started negotiation with the Palestinian Authority. And there was this sense of optimism that peace is possible and that things are going to change. After Rabin's assassination, there were continuous attacks in Israeli cities. the most extreme time was during the Second Intifada, so about year 2000 and on. A lot of suicide bombers managed to come into Israel, and they would search for the most populated sites, if it's a shopping mall or restaurants during an Israeli holiday where a lot of people would come out, or they would go on buses and they would blow themselves up. A lot of people, you know, running toward the bus, toward the restaurant, trying to help. And then a second bomb would be exploded from afar by phone. When I was in the 10th grade, it was year 2000, 2001, a suicide bomber went on a bus in Haifa, my hometown. So a lot of high school kids were on that bus. And he went on and blew himself up right in the middle of Haifa, in a very central street, and killed 19 people. Two of them were my classmates.
What impact did that have on you? I mean, what was your view of Palestinians growing up?
So I didn't understand this as inherent violence or people who just want to kill all of us no matter who we are. But I did had a very hard time imagining a person planning this kind of attack, planning the way to maximize the number of dead, to see that he will get young kids. And it was so depressing because we already started this other way of action by diplomacy, and now again all this violence, and it became really hard to believe that, you know, Palestinians will someday be willing to renounce violence and accept us as people who live in the same land as they are.
How did you get involved with the Combatants for Peace group?
Around the year 2014, it became harder and harder for me to not be active. In that year, Israel started the last war on Gaza. The way it was broadcast in the Israeli media was very hard for me to accept. We would get these horrific pictures from Gaza of entire neighborhoods being destroyed. We hear the number of casualties that reached thousands just in a few weeks, and many of them were kids. You know, growing up, we were always told that the IDF is unique.
This is the Israeli Defense Force?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry. The Israeli army is unique because its all purpose is defense, and it has a very high moral standard in a way that he won't directly attack civilian population. But in Gaza, there were airstrikes on civilian neighborhoods. And the way it was explained in the Israeli media was the fact that we gave these people 5 minutes warning to evacuate the building. And 5 minutes is just not enough. And you can see the result in the number of casualties. So I just couldn't sit at home and accept that this is what my government is doing in my name. So I started going to protest in Tel Aviv. There were big protests against the Gaza war. And in one of those protests, there were two speakers from an organization I didn't know at the time called Combatants for Peace. One of them was Israeli and one of them was Palestinian. And they presented themselves and called us to join them in nonviolence struggle and to stop the war on Gaza. And the Palestinian speaker was so impressive. He talked to us in Hebrew. He called us to renounce violence. He called us to join hand in the effort to build a future for both nations. And I just thought, I mean, how brave is this man to come to us, to the middle of Israel, in while there's a war going on? So I just had to look up this organization.
What was the atmosphere or the reaction in your community when you wanted to get involved in this?
I have the support of my close family. My parents, luckily, are very, very supportive and proud of what I'm doing. I think other people, I guess, consider me as a bit naive, working toward peace, you know, it's not the 90s anymore. But there are other parts of the Israeli society that I know through social media that consider me as very dangerous, working with Palestinian, working with Arabs. I'm naive to the point that I'm endangering Israel. Practically, I'm a traitor to my people.
Are you both in danger for the work you do?
He always says that when they do join forces and they're walking on the streets, it's like they're walking on streets with broken glass. There are people that are in support of them and are in awe of what they're doing, and then there are people that are also against them and what they're doing.
Noga, what about you?
I think the most scary day for us is on Memorial Day. In Israel, one day before we celebrate our Independence Day, we have a day that we call it Memorial Day, and in that day we commemorate soldiers who lost their life fighting for Israel since before the formation of the State of Israel and since. Last years, we also remember the names of those who were killed in terror attacks. So it's a very emotional time in Israel. And for the last 12 years, Combatants for Peace is doing Israeli-Palestinian joint memorial service, in which we commemorate the victims in both sides. And we remember the names of the victims, both Israeli and Palestinian. And we share our grief. And we hear each other's stories, even the most difficult ones. This event for many Israeli is extremely moving and hopeful. Last year, about 5,000 Israelis attended this ceremony. Every year we have to get a bigger auditorium, and last year it was the biggest one yet, and still we couldn't fit all the people. This ceremony is broadcast live, and we get hundreds of thousands of people watching it around the world. And still, for many Israelis, it's very hard. It touches them in a very soft spot, and they feel that we don't honor the one that they lost. And so there is a protest in front of the ceremony. And last year, the protest got extremely violent. Members of Combatants for Peace had to join hand in a row in order to enable people to just walk in the building. And you know, these are Israelis who chose to spend Memorial Days there like this. These are bereaved parents who feel that the best way to commemorate their son or daughter is by doing something that will make us hopeful for the future, to make sure that we'll be no more bereaved families. And they got spitting on and cursed, and it was scary to get them back to their cars.
Where do you find hope that you'll succeed?
The more people, both Israeli and Palestinian, decided to walk together, I think we each day and each month and each year, we feel how much our cause is combined and how much we have in common looking toward to the future. And, you know, I think whoever joins us in Combatants for Peace will be much more hopeful for the future.
He thinks that if we lose hope, we basically lose life. He gets hope from an Israeli girl who is one of her fathers, is also one of the founders for Combatants of Peace, who refused to serve in the Israeli Defense Force and was imprisoned. He gets hope from our humanity that is stronger than the bullets and the gas, tear gas that is being thrown, and the violence that is being used by the occupation forces.
You can hear more from Noga Harpaz and Raid Al-Hadar with Combatants for Peace in our hour-long version of this program or in the complete interview recordings, both available at our website, peacetalksradio.com. Now we turn to Megan Kamrick's conversation with Peter T. Coleman. He's a psychologist with the Teachers College at Columbia University and director of the Morton Deutsch International Center for Cooperation and Conflict Resolution. Coleman says, contrary to what we may believe, very few conflicts become intractable quagmires.
There are two men, Paul Diehl and Gary Goetz, who are political scientists, who study something called the Correlates of War database. It's a database that's about a 200-year-long database that looks at how different states, different nations around the world have treated each other over that 200-year period. And so what they're able to do in a database like that is look at, you know, relationships between nations that get stuck in these more contentious, difficult, what they call enduring rivalries, what I would call intractable conflicts, where there is a lot of contempt and suspiciousness and enmity and competition that takes place between them, sometimes for 30, 40, 50 years. But even those kinds of more destructive relationships between nations can change and can end. But usually the things that lead to that are not what we usually employ, diplomacy or attempts at trade. Usually it takes something else to change that relationship because they've become so stuck in these quagmires. And so one of the things that they've found from their research is that when these situations change, about 75, 80% of them change within 10 years of what they call a political shock. So something big happens either locally, there's a coup attempt or assassination or something like that, or even at a higher level, there, you know, at the end of the Cold War was a major political shock. 9/11 was a major political shock. So something happens that destabilizes the status quo, and it leads to changes which lead to other changes which leads to other changes. And then what you can see about 10 years later, a sort of delayed effect of the political shock, is a kind of qualitative change in the nature of the relationships from these more intractable, destructive conflicts to actually a fairly rapid transition to peace.
You have written that we lack sufficient understanding about how to promote and sustain peace. Why do we have this gap? You alluded to the fact that in some of these conflicts, the things that we usually try are not going to work.
Right. What's interesting is, in some ways, you and I are having two different kinds of conversation right now. One is to try to understand conflict, particularly difficult conflicts that settle into destructive patterns, and how, you know, when do those change and how do you move out of those? A different kind of conversation is about peace. You know, why do some communities actually have sustainably peaceful societies? There is a colleague of mine named Douglas Fry, who's an anthropologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And he has, for about 30 years, studied peaceful societies around the world. He started because people didn't believe that humans were ever peaceful, and that is, in fact, wrong, that humans were basically peaceful in most of our history. You know, so for a couple of million years on this planet, humans, particularly in hunter-gatherer societies, were peaceful societies. About 10,000 years ago, when human groups stopped and sort of settled in areas and laid claim to areas, you know, sort of where there's good salmon fishing, for example, and started to gather stuff, that's when groups started to begin to attack each other and move into war. So war is a relatively new invention for humans. It's not that there wasn't violence and murder that would take place. And what Doug has been able to document in his research is that there are many societies. Some are more traditional local societies, all scaling all the way up to places like Costa Rica, Norway, Finland, Iceland, Denmark, who are sustainably peaceful societies, who have chosen peace for 50, 100 or more years. What we argue is that, you know, the international community has been trying to, the UN in particular, has been trying to understand how to sustain peace. They've been trying to reorganize their peace building and peacemaking infrastructure at the UN towards the goal of sustaining peace. What they find is that most of what they do is mitigate crises, you know, and try to deal with the more acute problems. And that a lot of what they do in terms of peacemaking isn't sustainable. It doesn't last. So they've been trying to, you know, sort of set a more aspirational goal towards sustaining peace at, in their work at the international level. And part of what we argue is that, well, one of the reasons why the international community doesn't do that well, or really doesn't even know how to do that well, is because peaceful societies are rarely studied. There are very few academics or policymakers that study peaceful societies. Humans study the things they fear, you know, cancer, depression, anxiety. Those are the things that we put so much time and energy into trying to understand. We rarely study more pro-social or positive experiences and environments. It's taken many disciplines decades to to shift and study things like love and joy and flow at work. And the same is true for peace. There's peace studies and there are peace scholars, but mostly they're studying peacekeeping, peacemaking, and peacebuilding in the context of war. How do you get out of war? How do you try to transition away from that? And what we found is that the conditions that lead to sustainably peaceful societies are fundamentally different from the conditions that keep nations from sliding back into war. You need them both. You need to understand the things that sort of prevent violence and that mitigate violence and destructive conflict, and you need to understand those things that foster more sustainably peaceful relationships between groups and societies.
What are the components of a peaceful society?
It's really when members of any one group, take a religious group, any one religious group treats a member of another religious group with sort of respect and rapport and dignity, and that is reciprocated. So when you have that basic dynamic where Muslims treat Hindus in more respectful, dignified ways, and Hindus respond in kind, when you have that kind of what we call positive reciprocity, it's a basic mechanism that at that level kind of emerges into sort of norms and institutions and taboos about how people and groups treat each other that become sustainable. So what we find is that you need to have, in any kind of community, basically a strong ratio of more positive encounters between members of group and a weaker ratio of negative encounters. It doesn't mean that negative encounters don't happen or shouldn't happen, because in fact, what people and groups learn from negative encounters from one another is insights to prevent it or how to work through it constructively. So those kinds of conflicts are useful in terms of helping communities grow and deal with inequalities and injustices. But if you don't have a sufficient kind of context of respect, what we call a positivity reservoir between members of different groups, then those negative encounters take over. And they really start to lead to more competitive, contentious dynamics. What eventually that does, it affects how the groups think about the future, how they plan for things together. It ultimately affects the kind of norms and institutions that exist in that society, how children are socialized to treat members of other groups, how they're educated about their histories in relation to other groups. When you have members of different groups treating each other with respect as opposed to with contempt, then what bubbles up are these norms and institutions and historical memories and plans for the future that perpetuate more peaceful societies.
You and your colleagues have written about the necessity of having a vision of what peacefulness looks like. What if people have competing visions of what they think peacefulness looks like?
So there are oftentimes these kind of competing narratives that are out there. The question is whether or not the case is made. So one of the cases that Doug Fry has studied is the Iroquois Nation that existed in upstate New York. There were multiple tribes. The tribes were at war for centuries. And at some point, the myth is that sort of the great leader kind of came up and had this vision of a federation where they would sort of join together and support each other in a more cooperative, collaborative way. There was a group of sort of wise women that were running these sort of safe houses and places, and they became sort of disciples of this vision. And they started to promote this idea of a vision for how these nations would come together. And it perpetuated a vision of peace and a reality of peace for centuries until, of course, the Europeans came in and basically slaughtered many of them, which led to another set of problems. But what the point I'm trying to make is that at a time when there is a lot of suspiciousness and enmity and contempt for members of other groups, You can get charismatic visionary leaders that sort of step up. And I want to be careful about how we think about leadership, because it isn't always just one great man that stands up and makes this. It's oftentimes a group of people that sort of see it together and mobilize it together, men and women, and who are able to make that case and make it in a compelling way and really articulate what that vision is and the benefits of that for moving societies forward.
How would things change in the world if we implemented some of these ideas you're talking about, if we actually studied peaceful societies?
What we've been trying to do here, we're about 4 years into, I would say, probably about a 10-year project to identify the research that's out there on peaceful societies and then to sort of present it in ways to policymakers that help them understand it as a system, that there is no one magic bullet, but that there are a combination of things that feed each other that create these more robust, peaceful communities and nations. And then to give them some sort of decision-making tools to help them understand that there are sometimes unintended negative consequences of well-intentioned actions. I think that's oftentimes what happens with a lot of international policymaking or programming that's sort of top-down, is that there sometimes is equal harm and equal good done. Part of what we're trying to do is educate policymakers and decision makers at the UN and elsewhere about complex systems. Like, how do you work with complex systems? What are the things that you shouldn't do that will harm? And what are the things that you should do? In a complex system, local solutions that emerge from within the system, from within the community, if they've come up and been sustained in the community, they're usually much more sustainable than anything an external actor can bring in from the outside. I had a colleague named Laura Chasen, who was a brilliant colleague who worked on a lot of divisive issues through a group out of Cambridge called the Public Conversations Project. And what Laura would say is that the first thing she would do when she was invited into a community to help them work on some very polarizing issue is she would try to identify what she called the networks of effective action. Who are local actors on the ground, even in a very polarized, sometimes unsafe place, who are still in communication and dialogue across the other side? Sometimes they're clergy, sometimes they're merchants who are, you know, just trying to run their cafe and keep the doors open to members of both groups. But who are those folks that are already effectively navigating this polarization and mitigating it? And is there a way to support what they do and encourage what they do already that will help it scale up and help it be a more robust internal intervention? Because usually those are much more effective than bringing any, you know, half-baked ideas in from the outside.
As with our other guests, you can hear much more from Peter Coleman, Megan's complete interview with him, and our hour-long version of this September 2018 episode on creating and sustaining peace. Find it all at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's where you can go to find details on all the episodes in our series going back to 2002. You'll find audio from the programs that you can stream or download. You'll find partial transcripts. You'll also see other websites and resources on each topic that we've covered in our Peace Talks Radio series. All at peacetalksradio.com. That's also where you can go to offer your support to this program. Your support is necessary and appreciated. You can find a donate button on the homepage of our website, peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, along with Megan Kamrick. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting Peace Talks Radio.